This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Good evening. My name is Kate Daniels. Thank you all for coming tonight, and thank you to the Lannan Foundation for their sponsorship of this reading and conversation series, which, as you all know, has become such an essential part of our national dialogue about literature and the arts. I have the pleasure and the privilege this evening of introducing you to Tony Hoagland. Tony Hoagland was born in 1953. His father was a military doctor, and he spent his childhood on various military bases throughout the South. He did his undergraduate work at Williams College and the University of Iowa, then received an MFA in creative writing from the University of Arizona. Tony Hoagland is the author of three highly lauded volumes of poetry, a book of criticism, several chapbooks, and a forthcoming poetry collection. His books, many of them, will be for sale after the reading out in the lobby, I believe, and you are invited to come by and make a purchase and say a few words with Tony, and he will be very glad to sign books for you. His books of poetry include Sweet Ruin, which was published in 1992 as the winner of the Brittingham's Prize. It was selected for that honor by the eminent Donald Justice. Donkey Gospel was his second volume. It received the James Laughlin Award and was published in 1998. In 2003, the divertingly titled What Narcissism Means to Me was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. A book of his essays on poetry and craft, Real Sophistication, was published also in 2003. And later, I'm not sure if it's later this year or early next year, Grey Wolf Press will publish his newest collection of poems, which is entitled Have I Got News for You? In addition to those honors that I've just mentioned, Tony Hoagland has won numerous other prizes for his work, including a Guggenheim Fellowship, the Poetry Foundation's Mark Twain Award for Humor, two NEA grants, a Pushcart Prize, et cetera, et cetera. I think you probably get the picture. Although he is on sabbatical this fall and spending time on Cape Cod, where he and his wife own a home, he is on the permanent faculty of the MFA program in creative writing at the University of Houston, and he also teaches in the low residency MFA program at Warren Wilson College in North Carolina. Okay, so that's that. Now I'll say what I really want to say. There could hardly be a more fitting moment to be introducing Tony Hoagland than this one, almost precisely this moment, when the final presidential debate of what is being called the most important presidential election of our time is getting ready to commence on Long Island in New York. As the country gathers to listen, all of our Americanness seems somehow as if it has been boiled down to two competing voices and consciousnesses. And even though each voice is as American as the proverbial apple pie, they are, in fact, fundamentally, even sometimes radically different, each from the other. Beneath the big tent of our citizenship, some of us cleave to one vision, some of us cleave to the other. Likewise, I sometimes think of Tony Hoagland's poetry as if he had figured out how to boil down all that makes us identifiably American and compacted that massive commingling of diversity, conflict, enthusiasm, energy, rage, naivete, ambition, grandiosity, and sentimentality into something like sharp-edged, brilliantly potent bouillon cubes of poems. Somehow, Hoagland's poems are simultaneously comfortably familiar, what he calls this ordinary life of ants and sandwich wrappers, and at the same time, threateningly strange. In each one, in each poem of his that we read, we meet ourselves, and we also meet our very worst enemies right at the same time. Tony Hoagland is, I believe, for our baby boomer generation of poets, what the great poet of modernism, William Carlos Williams, called a pure product of America. What you will hear in the poems that he reads to you this evening is an American original, a voice for our time as unique as Williams was in his time, and just as obsessed with getting right the sound of being American. In an essay written somewhat earlier in 1844, Ralph Waldo Emerson pondered what went into the formation of a uniquely identifiably American poet. rejecting the European Parnassian model as inappropriate for the world's first democracy, Emerson taught that the American poet is representative. He stands among partial men for the complete man and apprises us not of his wealth, but of the common wealth. The poet, the American poet, Emerson tells us, is only half himself. The other half is his expression. I can't think of a better example of this than Tony Hoagland, a poet who brings at least half of himself to many of his poems, not to inform us about the state of his consciousness, but to hotwire our literary imaginations to the center of the 21st century in America, forcing us, for once, to slow down and think about it. Hoagland cuts to the chase of life in our time, focusing relentlessly, and I have to say sometimes sickeningly, on our culture's obsessive materialism that has worked its way over the centuries into compulsive orgies of shopping and acquiring, what he calls a satin-lined nightmare of materialism, and a landscape that seemed, in the brightness and abundance of its goods, like somebody's idea of paradise. His poems speak as well of our well-known hot-headedness and easily aroused impulsivity, the way we pledge our allegiance to the pleasure and not the consequence, as he puts it. His works speak about, again and again, our iconic national itchy foot. "It seems I have the traveling disease again," he says in a poem called Perpetual Motion, an outbreak of that virus celebrated by the cracked lips of 1,000 blues musicians. Hoagland's poems are filled with the detritus of consumer capitalism and media culture, on-ramps and mega malls, rock music and rap, Ford Mustangs and Hondas, bottomless styrofoam cups of coffee, televised congressional hearings, Tupperware containers, and 7-Elevens. But always the counterpoint to this terrible trivializing of our human potential is found in the body, usually the body in love or lust, but also the body afloat in water. For Tony Hoagland, even at his most world-weary and all but cynical, there is still a newness and an authenticity of expression that provides relief from the crushing weight of life in our time. Whether in kissing or in making love or in floating temporarily weightless in a quiet pond, these small reverberating privacies redeem our shared struggle to stay emotionally alive and remain hopeful, if possible, in these weird times, as Hoagland says, deep inside the misery of daily life. As you can probably tell, I think Tony Hoagland is a magnificent poet, not only of and for our time, but for the ages to come, whatever and however they may turn out to be. So thank you for coming here this evening instead of staying home to watch a presidential debate on television, and please join me in welcoming Tony Hoagland.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much for coming. I want to thank the Lannan family and the Lannan Foundation for having me here. My eyes will adjust so that I can see you soon. I've admired so many products of the Lannan Foundation, and since I became webcast literate, I started downloading their amazing podcasts, and I so admire the breadth of the speakers and performers that come to this series, like Naomi Klein or Wallace Shawn or Noam Chomsky, and it's one of the few, listening to those people speak, public thinkers taking responsibility for our time, it actually gives you a kind of hope that that there might be some honesty and insight, you know, left. There might be some grown-ups left in the world. We know trickle-down economics doesn't work, but trickle-down stupidity works far too well. And I'm thrilled to be here. And I also want to thank the poet Kate Daniels so much for her beautiful introduction and for, you know, taking the time to come here and introduce and talk with me. She's a delight to talk to. So every once in a while during the reading, I'm just going to say, I'm a maverick, and I've always been a maverick. And my administration is going to do the things that mavericks do. The first poem I'm going to read is an odd poem. It's as the frame of the reality we live in keeps shifting, it becomes not Stalin but Walmart, you know, that seems to be, you know, the great dark force. And you can, you know, it's a profound paradigm shift. That's the language. But when you see wars being contracted out, you can sort of see at one point we're all going to need corporate sponsors, and we'll all be working for corporations. And I foresee a time, you know, when we will have names, you know, like, you know, Merck and Donald Pepsi Cola and Tiffany Sears. No, Sears is bankrupt, but. Tiffany 7-Eleven, the entire 7-Eleven clan has been done so much for our country. So this is sort of imagining a future in which the UN peacekeeping troops, you know, have Coca-Cola logos on their uniforms. It's called Invitation to the Future. From here, I can almost read the invitation. Jack and Tanika Mitsubishi announced the wedding of their daughter, Jessica Exxon Mitsubishi, to Noah Coca-Cola from Pomona, California. The ceremony will be performed by the Reverend Thomas Walmart at the Microsoft Chapel on Zoloft Hill. Reception to follow at the Global Warming Pavilion. Just follow the sound of the air conditioners. The bride and groom met as students in the Ziploc technology program. And you can expect the predictable toast about how fresh the bride still looks. As the clouds pass over the long white tables and the Pepsodent String Quartet Orchestra tunes up their pure white instruments. From here, I can almost guess the logo on their bathroom towels. What they will call their children, her silly names for his thingamajig. Noah and Jessica, Jessica and Noah, Noah and Jessica, Coca-Cola, Mitsubishi. Long may they prosper. And when they are used and bruised, weather-beaten and dented, when life has disenfranchised them, may they find a place to hide. Under the world of merchandise, as we did, their ancestors, so long ago, who lived in a place now vaguely known, only dimly remembered as the private sector. I have a lot of friends here in Santa Fe. And I'm so glad to be able to read for them. One of them is Rob Wilder, who teaches at Santa Fe Prep and can't be here, but he's been injecting generations of prep students with my poems, and I want to read this poem for him and them. It's a poem about the terrors of being a pubescent boy, that a somewhat unadvertised kind of purgatory. And it's also a poem about language and about the power of cursing. I like potty mouth. I always have. We'll be talking about that later in the conversation. But I can remember when I was young, the power of cursing. And in a very powerless time, it's a great thing. It's a great inheritance to come into, is being able to curse. And so this poem is about that. It's called Dickhead. This is to you, boys of Santa Fe Prep. To whoever taught me the word dickhead, I owe a debt of thanks. It gave me a way of being in the world of men when I most needed one. When I was pale and scrawny, naked, goose-fleshed as a plucked chicken in a supermarket cooler. A poor forked thing stranded in the savage universe of puberty, where wild jockstraps flew across the steamy skies of locker rooms, and everybody fell down laughing at jokes I didn't understand. But dickhead was a word as dumb and democratic as a hammer, an object you could pick up in your hand and swing, saying dickhead this and dickhead that. A song that meant the world was yours enough at least to bang on like a garbage can. And knowing it, and having that beautiful ugliness always cocked and loaded in my mind, protected me and calmed me like a psalm. Now I have myself become a beautiful ugliness, and my weakness is a fact so well established that it makes me calm. And I am calm enough to be grateful for the lives I never have to live again. But I remember all the bad old days back in the world of men, when everything was serious, mysterious, scary, hairier, and bigger than I was. I recall when flesh was what I hated, feared, and was excluded from. Hardly knowing what I did, or what would come of it, I made a word, my friend. And I'm going to read another poem. Thank you. Read another poem, which is sort of about childhood. My father was actually, he actually was a Green Beret. He had a Green Beret. And when we were kids, he took my brother and I out into the woods, and he told us how to survive in the wilderness. I mean, he didn't tell us enough, and we wouldn't have survived. But it seemed macabre, even at that time. But now I remember that it was the 1950s, Korea, not so long since World War II, and nuclear warfare, atom bombs. It makes more sense in the past tense. But this is about that experience. Another chapter in the brutalization of the young man. A sentimental education. And when we were 8 or 9, our father took us back into the Alabama woods, found a great big log, and with his hunting knife, pried off a slab of bark to show the 100 kinds of running bugs and grubs that we would have to eat in time of war. The ones who will survive, he told us, staring at us hard, are the ones who are willing to do anything. Then he popped one of those pale slugs into his mouth and started chewing. And that was lesson number 4 in the Green Beret Book of Child Rearing. I looked at my pale, scrawny, knock-kneed, bug-eyed brother, who was identical to me, and saw that in a world that ate the weak, we didn't have a prayer. And next thing I remember, I'm working for a living at a boring job, which I'm afraid of losing, with a wife whose lack of love for me is like a lack of oxygen, and this dead thing in my chest that used to be my heart. Oh, if he were alive, I would tell him, "Dad, you were right. I ate a lot of stuff far worse than bugs. And I was eaten. I was eaten. I was picked up and chewed and swallowed down into the belly of the world." I lived in Berkeley for a period of time. which Santa Fe distantly reminds me of. And it was kind of like a theme park. It had a lot of vibrancy, and I knew I had to leave when I was talking to somebody who had a business card. On the one side it said media handler, on the other side it said dream consultant. She said, "How do you like Berkeley?" I said, "It's okay." She said, "If you don't love it, you have to leave." And, you know, she was right. So this is sort of my poem, you know. I wanted to document everything before while it was fresh in my mind. The poem's called Here in Berkeley. Here in Berkeley, the jogger with the Rastafarian sweats runs past the mechanic reading Marx on lunch break with a Sprout sandwich for a bookmark as the sunlight through a bottle of Perrier wobbles little rainbows on his knee. On the corner, someone wearing I Ching earrings is talking about personal space, how she just can't take it anymore, the way that Marsh's codependency defeats her own empowerment. "The whole seminar is out of whack," she says, slapping a bouquet of daisies on her knee. "Close your eyes. Swing a baguette horizontally. You'll hit someone with a PhD in sensitivity. Someone who, if not a therapist himself, will offer you the number of his therapist, which, it may take you years to figure out, is a hostile act on his part, designed to send you on a wild goose chase through the orchard of your childhood to fetch the tarnished apple of your mother's love. And if you don't like it, there might be something wrong with you. You might be so reincarnationally headed in the wrong direction that you can't hear the music hovering above this zone of crystal vendors and karmic mountaineers. Now the traffic lights harmonically converge. The traffic flows past the bakeries and bookstores, past the cappuccino depot and the acupuncture center. No matter how you feel, you have to act like you are very popular with yourself. Very relaxed and purposeful. Very unconfused. And not like you are walking through the sunshine, singing in chains. Thank you. This is a poem that I wrote the summer I lived in Washington, D.C., the summer we lived in Washington, D.C., right after that time that the mysterious snipers appeared and started shooting people at random. And you'll remember that it was a phenomenon that didn't have an explanation for a while, and therefore it invited, you know, all the grasping of many explanations. Terrorists, you know, have we sinned against God's will? It was a good season for evangelism and Homeland Security, which hadn't been invented yet. But and so this poem sort of is about that, is about the effort to explain things that we don't understand. Summer. God moves mysterious thunderheads over the towns and office buildings, cracks them open like raw eggs. The north has critical humidity. The south plucks at its sweaty clothes. The weatherman says it's August and a sniper is haunting Washington, D.C. He's picking victims at random from shopping malls and parking lots, touching them with bullets like blue fingertips. And some say he's an unemployed geek with a chip on his shoulder. And some say he's an agent of ancient Greek theology. Gibbs says the sniper is a surrealist travel agent booking departures only. Or he's a Dada lawyer without a client, arguing in 30 caliber sentences. Robin says the sniper is what the country invented as a symptom of its mental illness. And Marcia is sad because she knows the sniper could have been cured by a regimen of vitamins and serotonin reuptake inhibitors. We had fallen into one of our periodic comas of obesity and celebrity when the sniper went off like an alarm clock. And the preacher on TV said that he had come according to Revelations 3:14 to punish us for the crime of not being ready for death. But as Snoopy, the clerk at the 7-Eleven, said, what kind of crime is that? Meanwhile, the air conditioners are working overtime. The rooftops are full of SWAT teams and camera crews. The sky, too, is mobilizing. Dark clouds without speaking. Menacing millennial clouds. We don't know yet what the metaphysical facts are. We don't know if our sniper is domestic or foreign terror, what color the chip on his shoulder is, or what we will do if the sniper chooses us tomorrow. But when we go out now, we feel our nakedness. Each step has a slender string attached. And when we move more quietly. As we slide between the sinners and the snipers and the summer in the simmering medicinal rain. I'm going to lay a poem on you, which is, I've never read it before, and it's not that I'm afraid of reading it, it's just a lot of data, and I don't want to wear you out. It's called Dialectical Materialism. Dialectical Materialism. That's not meant to intimidate. It's meant to, it's a sort of play on words. The term is Marx's about the progress of history, the evolution of history. But this is about walking into a supermarket. And if you were totally aware when you walked into the supermarket and you could sort of understand that in this agora, all these things had come together in this blinding kind of superfluity, you know, and they all have stories behind them. As a matter of fact, when I watched the Wallace Shawn Lannan video read his amazing, amazing monologue, Fever, he talks about how he reads a book on Marxism, and for a short period of time, he realizes the Marxist insight that everything, like this shirt, has a history. It was made in a country by somebody. It traveled across the sea. And if you could see all the history of everything in the supermarket, you would be flummoxed. And in this poem, everything is talking at once. And so it's in a big dialogue. I was thinking about dialectical materialism at the supermarket, strolling among the Chilean tomatoes and the Filipino pineapples, admiring the Washington State apples stacked in perfect pyramid displays by the ebony man from Zimbabwe wearing the Chicago Bulls t-shirt. I was seeing the whole produce section as a system of cross-referenced signifiers in a textbook on historical economics, and the fine spray that misted the vegetables was like the cool mist of style imposed on meaning. It was one of those days when interpretation is brushing its varnish over everything, when even the birds are speaking complex sentences, and the sun is a brassy blonde novelist of immense accomplishment, dictating her new blockbuster to a stenographer who types at the speed of light and publishes each page as fast as it is written. There was cornbread rising in the bakery department, and in its warm aroma, I believed that I could smell the exhaled breath of vanished Iroquois, their journey west and delicate withdrawal into the forests, whereas, by comparison, the coarse-grained wheat baguettes seemed to irrepressibly exude the sturdy sweat and labor of 18th-century Europe. My God, there is so much sorrow in the grocery store. You would have to be high on the fumes of piped-in pan flutes, on the fumes of piped-in pan flutes of commodified Peruvian folk music, not to be driven practically crazy with awe and shame, not to weep at the scale of subjugated matter, the ripped-up etymologies of kiwi fruit and bratwurst, the roads paved with dead languages, the jungles digested by foreign money. It's the owners, I said to myself, it's the horrible juggernaut of progress. But the cilantro in my hand opened up its bitter, minty ampule underneath my nose, and the bossa nova muzak charmed me like a hypnotist, and the pretty cashier with the shaved head and nose ring said, "Have a nice day," as I burst with my groceries through the automatic doors into the open sky and air. But I was also in a giant parking lot at a mega mall outside of Minneapolis, where in row E87, a Ford Escort from Mankato had just had a fender bender with a Honda from Miami. And these personified proportions of my heart, the drivers, were standing there in the gathering Midwestern granular descending dusk, waiting for the trooper to fill out the accident report, with the rotating red light of the squad car whipping in circles above them, splashing their shopped-out middle-aged faces strangely with war paint the hue of cherry Gatorade. And each of them was thinking how with dialectical materialism, accidents happen. How, at any minute, convenience can turn into a kind of trouble you never wanted. This is a similar but less Touretic poem. And it's about being in an important place in our culture, the food court, where, again, there's a conversation between, you know, marvelously disparate elements, and they're all talking to each other, and how could you say what it means? But in its presence, you know, you experience something. Food court. If you want to talk about America, why not just mention Jimmy's Walk and Roll American Chinese Gourmet Emporium? The cloud of steam rising from the bean sprouts and shredded cabbage. When the oil is sprayed on from a giant plastic bottle, wielded by Ramon, Jimmy's main employee, who hates having to wear the sanitary hairnet and who thinks the food smells shitty. And the secretaries from the law firm drifting in from work at noon to fill the tables of the food court in their cotton skirts and oddly sexy running shoes. Why not mention the little grove of palm trees maintained by the mall corporation and the splashing fountain beside it and the faint smell of dope smoke drifting from the men's room where two boys from the suburbs dropped off by their moms with their baggy ghetto pants and skateboards are getting ready to pronounce their first sentences in African American. Oh, yes, everything all chopped up and stirred together in the big steel pan held over a medium-high blue flame while Jimmy watches with his practical black eyes. And Kate may have mentioned this in her introduction. It's a theme that both of us have tried to work with in our poetry. The great American secret, racism in America. And I've tried to write about race a number of times from the point of view of white anxiety. And this poem is about that moment when one might be stopped in traffic, and suddenly the car begins to shake, because a car is pulled up alongside you, and that the very expensive bass speakers are turned way up. It's called Rap Music. 26 men trapped in a submarine are pounding on the walls with a metal pipe, shouting what they'll do when they get out. Or they are rolled up in a rug in the back of a rug truck that has wrecked. No, it's the car pulled up next to mine in traffic, with the windows rolled down and the sound turned up, so loud it puts everything in italics. Enough to make the asphalt thump and the little leaves of shrubbery in front of the nice brick houses quake. I don't know what's going on inside that portable torture chamber. But I have a bad suspicion that there's a lot of dead white people in there. On a street lit by burning police cars, where a black man is striking the head of a white one again and again with a brick, then lifting the skull to drink blood from the hole. But that's what art is for, isn't it? It's about giving expression to the indignation. It's about taking the in out of inhibition. So maybe my ears are just a little hysterical. Or maybe my fear is just a little historical. And you know, I'd like to form an exploratory committee to investigate that question. And I'd like that committee to produce a documentary called The Complexifamacious Sounds of Afro-America. But all this ugly noise is getting in my way. And what I'm not supposed to say is that black, for me, is a country more foreign than China or vagina, more alarming than going down Niagara on Viagra. And it makes me feel stupid when I get close, like a little white dog on the edge of a big dark woods I'm not supposed to look directly into. And there's this pounding noise, like a heartbeat full of steroids, like 1,000 schizophrenic Shakespeares killing themselves at high volume. This tangled roar that has to be shut up or blown away or sealed off or actually mentioned and entered. A kind of change of pace. I started at some point writing poems that were no longer narrative poems or even exactly argumentative poems, discursive poems, but they just sort of plucked different details from an environment and tried to sort of arrange them in a way that made a kind of composite portrait with no particular point. And this is one of the ones that I wrote, and the speaker is just driving in the poem and thinking about this and that and everything. It's called A Color of the Sky. Windy today, and I feel less than brilliant, driving over the hills from work. There are the dark parts of the road when you pass through clumps of wood, and the bright spots where you have a view of the ocean. But that doesn't make the road an allegory. I should call Marie and apologize for being so boring at dinner last night. But can I really promise not to be that way again? And anyway, I'd rather watch the trees tossing in what certainly looks like sexual arousal. It's spring, and everything looks frail. The sky is baby blue, and the just unfurling leaves are full of infant chlorophyll, the very tint of inexperience. Last summer's song is making a comeback on the radio, and on the highway overpass, the only metaphysical vandal in America has painted "Memory Loves Time" in big black spray paint letters, which makes us wonder if time loves memory back. Last night, I dreamed of X again. She's like a stain on my subconscious sheets. Years ago, she penetrated me. And though I scrubbed and scrubbed and scrubbed, I never got her out. But now I'm glad. What I thought was an end turned out to be a middle. What I thought was a brick wall turned out to be a tunnel. What I thought was an injustice turned out to be a color of the sky. Outside the youth center, between the liquor store and the police station, a little dogwood tree is losing its mind, overflowing with blossom foam, like a sudsy mug of beer, like a bride ripping off her clothes, dropping snow-white petals to the ground in clouds. So nature's wastefulness seems quietly obscene. It's been doing that all week, making beauty and throwing it away and making more. Okay. This is a poem about the moment that the modern moment when you're in a drugstore or someplace and you're looking for some product that you need and you hear coming through the perforated speakers over your head a song that you once loved which has been turned into synthesized violin music. You know, the words have been stripped from it, and there's nothing left, and you realize that something bad has happened. And in this case, the song that's being named is the apocalyptic song "It's a Hard Rain's Gonna Fall" by Bob Dylan. And the poem kind of jumps around from one kind of modern moment to another. So, if you just sort of have to go with it. Hard rain. And you know, when you hear hard rain turned into music, you know the hard rain has already fallen. And it's suspiciously soft. After I heard "It's a Hard Rain's Gonna Fall," played softly by an accordion quartet, through the ceiling speakers of the Springdale shopping mall, I understood. There's nothing we can't pluck the stinger from. Nothing we can't turn into a soft drink flavor or a t-shirt. Even serenity can become something horrible if you make a commercial about it, using smiling, white-haired people quoting Thoreau to sell retirement homes in the Everglades, where the swamp has been drained and bulldozed into a 19-hole golf course with electrified alligator barriers. You can't keep beating yourself up, Billy, I heard the therapist say on television to the teenage murderer about all those people you killed. You just have to be the best person you can be, one day at a time. And everybody in the audience claps and weeps a little because the level of deep feeling has been touched. And they want to believe that the power of forgiveness is greater than the power of consequence or history. Dear Abby, my father is a businessman who travels. Each time he returns from one of his trips, his shoes and trousers are covered with blood. But he never forgets to bring me a nice present. Should I say something? Signed, America. I used to think I was not part of this, that I could mind my own business and get along. But that was just another song that had been taught to me since birth, whose words I was humming under my breath as I was walking through the Springdale Mall. I'm going to read some more personal poems now. This is a poem. I read some poems earlier. I wrote a lot of poems for, exploring masculinity. And this is a poem which is sort of exploring, I guess it's exploring beauty as it exists in women's lives and that sort of incredible passage that I guess the lucky ones among us who got the chance to be beautiful in the first place have to grapple with. Beauty. When the medication she was taking caused tiny vessels in her face to break, leaving faint but permanent blue stitches in her cheeks, my sister said she knew she would never be beautiful again. After all those years of watching her reflection in the mirror, sucking in her stomach and standing straight, she said it was a relief being done with beauty. But I could see her pause inside that moment as the knowledge spread across her face with a fine distress, sucking the peach out of her lips, making her cute nose seem, for the first time, a little knobby. I'm probably the only one in the whole world who actually remembers the year in high school when she perfected the art of being a dumb blonde. Spending recess on the breezeway by the physics lab, tossing her hair and laughing that canary trill which was her specialty, while some football player named Johnny, with a pained expression in his eyes, wrapped his thick finger over and over again in the bedspring of one of those pale curls. Or how she spent the next decade of her life auditioning a series of tall men, looking for just one with the kind of attention span that she could count on. Then one day, her time of prettiness was over, done, finito. And all those other beautiful women in the magazines and on the streets just kept on being beautiful everywhere you looked, walking in that kind of elegant, disinterested trance in which you sense they always seem to have one hand touching the secret place that keeps their beauty safe, inhaling and exhaling the perfume of it. It was spring, season when the young buttercups and daisies climb up on the mulched bodies of their forebears to wave their flags in the parade. My sister just stood still for 30 seconds, amazed by what was happening. That, too, was beautiful. And I'll read a couple of poems about love. I guess that passage that the last poem is about, that transition, you know, which goes unspoken about, like so many, so many violent self-adjustments. It, you know, getting older, you realize, you know, how rotten it is, and you can't, and you can't believe how many people have undergone it in the past, and how little they complained. It's just amazing. And so this is sort of about, you know, this is sort of about a stage of love which doesn't go named often. It's called love. The man who cannot make love to his wife with the erectile authority of yesteryear must lower his head and suck her breasts with the tenderness and careful acumen of Walt Whitman. And if the woman has lost her breasts to the surgeon and his silver knife, she must hump the man's leg in the dark bedroom like a jockey in the Kentucky Derby. Let them be hard and wet again, respectively. Let them convince and be convinced. It is the kind of heroic performance that no one will ever mention. It is the part of the staircase where the passage is the part of the journey where the staircase gets narrow and you must turn sideways to pass. Over the earth, the clouds mutate and roll. The trees catch their breath for another try. Wind rips through the dried out grass with a threshing sound. The man going under the covers. The woman letting him, both of them refusing to be stopped by shame. All that talk about love, and this is what that word was pointing toward. And I'll read two or three more poems. This is a poem I sort of have to read because it actually features the Santa Fe Plaza in it. And it's about two people who are on early in their romantic adventure, and they by some kind of misjudgment, they've gone to see a nature documentary, one of those ones which anthropomorphizes the habits, the mating habits of numerous kinds of species. You know, so it says, you know, the cheetah is a quick lover, you know, or, you know, the wild goose mates for life, or, you know, the kangaroo rat is a shy suitor, you know, things like that. They've seen this documentary and it's contaminated their consciousness in a way that seems probably fatal to their budding relationship. It's called Romantic Moment. After seeing the nature documentary, we walk down Canyon Road onto the plaza of art galleries and high-end clothing stores, where the mock orange is fragrant in the summer night and the smooth adobe walls glow flesh-like in the dark. It is just our second date, and we sit down on a bench, holding hands, not looking at each other. And if I were a bull penguin right now, I would lean over and vomit softly into the mouth of my beloved. And if I were a peacock, I'd flex my gluteal muscles to erect and spread the quills on my Cinemax tail. If she were a female walking stick bug, she might insert her hypodermic proboscis delicately into my neck and inject me with a rich hormonal sedative before attaching her egg sac to my thoracic undercarriage. And if I were a young chimpanzee, I would break off a nearby tree limb and smash all the windows in the Plaza jewelry stores. And if she was a Brazilian leopard frog, she would wrap her impressive tongue three times around my right thigh and pummel me lightly against the surface of our pond. And I would know her feelings were sincere. Instead, we sit a while in silence until she remarks that in the relative context of tortoises and iguanas, human males seem to be actually rather expressive. And I say that female crocodiles really don't receive enough credit for their gentleness. And she suggests that it is time for us to go to get some ice cream cones and eat them. So I'm going to read one more poem. And this is a poem about, it's also in a way a poem about being in time. There's a certain point when all of your friends, well, and now it's just an American kind of OCD conversation. You know, everything moves so fast. I don't have time for anything. And but nobody really seems to have been able to solve the time problem. I know there probably are some people here who have solved it, but talk to me afterwards. So this is written, we lived in Washington, D.C. for a while, and Kathleen, my partner, and I, and it was a cold winter, and we lived in Foggy Bottom, which was just 5 blocks from the Vietnam War Monument. So there was a lot of American history sort of right in front of you. And I was reading the letters of Virginia Woolf, which are magnificent reading. And she's always, I couldn't work this month because I was sick. I had visitors. I had a horrible migraine. I can't work. And then you read, turn the page, and she says, I finished the book, you know, yesterday. And she's always finishing the book, even though she has these crippling migraines. So it's an interesting experience to read those. It's called The Time Wars, and I want to read this for my beloved Kathleen. It was the winter we ate a lot of oatmeal to stay warm. We lived on 17th and G Streets. Kath called it the G-spot. At night in the bathtub, I read the collected letters of Virginia Woolf, trying to keep the pages of 20th century prose from getting wet, reading the guest lists for her dinner parties as she knocked out book after book between her shattering depressions. Sometimes I would meet Richard at the Chinese place for dinner. And 1, 2, 3 hours would vanish like our food. We would stand outside the Great Wall, adjusting our scarves in a pastoral moment of urban separation, watching the cabs whiz by in the dusk. The Vietnam War Monument was just 5 blocks away. On Saturday, you would always see a vet or two in their windbreakers and baseball caps, heads down, crying in the shrubs, the little POW buttons and various insignia attached to their clothing like they were advertising something. We ourselves were fighting the time wars. We could feel it speeding up, rapidly escaping, like the hiss from a leaky balloon. We were trying to plug it, to slow it down, to decelerate, but none of us was having much success. One day in February, Kath brought in some roses and said, "Here, the sun came 93 million miles to make these flowers that I killed for you." And I said, "Kathleen, my talents are not capacious enough to properly exaggerate your virtues." And we both burst out laughing, and time stopped right over our heads like a little red car. On June 14th, 1942, Virginia Woolf wrote in her journal, "Windy day. I am the hare, far ahead of my critics, the hounds." Something endearing about that mixture of weather report and vanity. Something lonely about this image of success. We ourselves aren't thinking about the future anymore. What we want is to calm time down, to get time in a good mood, to make time feel wanted. We just want to give time many homemade gifts covered with fingerprints and kisses. Thank you. Thanks very much. Thank you for coming. I'm a maverick. I'll always be a maverick.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Hi, Kate.
Hi, Tony. Wow. Good reading, huh?
Thank you. Thank you for coming.
We can't see anything, but I think they're still there and they haven't rushed home to hear the debate. We talked just a little bit about sorts of things we might converse about in these few minutes that we have together. And we agreed we might start out by talking about voice. I think to me, certainly to me, and also to many critics who have written about your work, voice is the single most distinctive aspect of the most distinctive element of your poetry. And I would describe it as your unbelievably contemporary American voice, and how you render the cacophony of what we hear in the outside world every day into these marvelous poems is a mystery to me. So I want to ask you to talk about that a little bit. You have located yourself as sort of existing poetically somewhere between the confessional and the sociological, I think you said. And you mentioned Sharon Olds and Frank O'Hara as sort of signposts that would...
Your sound just went out. Is it back?
Okay. Yeah. And you've mentioned Sharon Olds and Frank O'Hara as a sort of poetic signposts representing each of those positions. So what I want to ask you about is just in general the whole sort of issue of voice and how much you're thinking about it when you're writing and all of that. But I'd like you to go back, if you would, a little bit farther in American literary history and say something about earlier progenitors, if there were any for you. The one I always think of, as I said in my introduction, was Williams, but wondering what you think.
Well, of course, we owe everything to Williams. And, you know, we got the first American plain-spoken and intimate voice out of him. the requirements on him at that time were, in some ways, to break the back of meter, to break the break rhyme and meter. And he did it but with that short line of his. Mm-hmm. And by his use of sort of colloquial speech, well, very plain-spoken speech, but not too idiomatic, not very furnished with images. Anyway, that's where American poetry, of course, stands on Williams. And eventually, through its many twists and turns, it evolved into, I think, the poetry of our generation, where mm-hmm. the American plain-spoken, mildly confessional work, for which Sharon Olds could stand, mm-hmm. could be one placeholder. Mm-hmm. Williams also, he talked about, he used that term indigenous American poetry that he wanted to write.
Right.
You know, it was the struggle for American identity in the arts, and it was, you know, the struggle that Williams fought to create a body of American poetry which was really distinctive poetry, and he believed that it belonged to regionalism. Mm-hmm. Now, regionalism apparently is no longer possible for us. That's one thing, which is a rather interesting shift in the dimensions of our situation. Mm-hmm. You can feel the poverty of regionalism, of inauthentic regionalism, when you follow the candidates and you listen to, you know, Obama, you know, go to West Virginia and start dropping his G's, or another even more mercenary kind of candidate, the kind who wears, you know, overalls to talk to the Iowans, you know, and you hear them try to create intimacy through regional dialect, and they're sadly it's inadequate. And part of it is that regionalism, you know, has been so altered and homogenized. But another is it's now American speech is multi-voiced, heteroglossaic. It's uh-huh. it's all a big welter, what you call a Tower of Babel.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so, in a way, for poetry to achieve the equivalent of that intimate, direct voice, if you really want to speak American, you know, you've got to speak American slang and American and drop the names of commercial products, and you've also got to integrate, you know, all the, you know, the pathos, the greed, the shame, you know, and all of those things go into making a convincing voice.
Mm-hmm.
You should say something now.
Well, so I guess what I'm interested in is how deliberate was your work to develop this particular voice?
Well, like you, I think, I was schooled, you know, weaned in the plain style, and frankly, it was all that I could handle, a sort of confessional. I wrote a confessional autobiographical poem about extremely personal. It was mostly inward-looking. It took place in the sphere of the family. And I was barely competent at it, mm-hmm. so I had to start there. And as I learned how to do that and to make an autobiographical narrative of crisis, you know, on the therapeutic right. model resolved in insight.
Right.
You know.
Got that.
You know, it started to seem inadequate to me, inadequate tonally, and also inadequate to the way that life was, because in my poems, the character would, you know, suffer some torment, self-made or imposed, have an insight, and everything would be solved. And I discovered that was my therapeutic model too. And if I just have the insight, you know, I can get out the other side of this, and I will be able to handle that situation in the future. It just turned out not to be true. Mm-hmm. I just kept having the same crises again and again. The insights they lasted about as long as some of the pills that we took. And that was a problem. And so I wanted to alter that narrative form, mm-hmm. and then I also wanted to get tonally more complex.
Okay. All right, well, let me sort of segue into something that I think is a little bit related to this. You published an essay that maybe some people out there have read. It originally appeared in Poetry Magazine, I believe, that got a good number of people pretty riled up. The essay was called Fear of Narrative and the Skittery Poem of Our Moment. Maybe some of you all read that. It's also in your book of essays. In that essay, you made what I would call a pretty hard case against what you call dissociative poetry. And you think of this, correct me if I'm wrong, as sort of the fashionable poetry of the moment. Younger poets in particular seem to be writing in this mode a lot. You accuse it, really, of refusing to cooperate with conventions of sense-making, and you suggest that it has a...
Refusing to cooperate with what?
With conventions of sense-making. That's you, not me. And you also accuse it of having a passive-aggressive relation to meaning.
Yeah.
And yet...
It's like, I prefer not
yeah,
to.
Yeah, right. But, and yet... The way you describe at length what you call dissociative poems is very similar to what you've just talked about in terms of trying to capture the Tower of Babel, you know, that's represented in American Voice. What's that
all
about?
Well, you know, it's a good question because in a lot of ways I think that, you know, I think the poetry that we need, not the only kind of poetry we need, but the one kind of poetry we need, is a kind of multi-voiced, tonally complex, full of ironies and paradoxes and contradictions. But I think that the difference between, you know, what these dissociative poets are doing, you know, God bless them, as we say in the South.
Right. Bless their hearts.
Yeah, bless their hearts. is... I think that it's really, I think it's an unintentional withdrawal from feeling and an unintentional withdrawal from the mission of poetry, from, you know, the charter of poetry to make meaning in the ways that poetry can make meaning, which I think poetry is profoundly... You know, facile and substantial. It can do, it can make meaning. It can, whether it's capturing, the contours and the multifacetedness of a particular contemporary moment, or whether it's saying, this is important, this is not important. You know, poetry has power. Their writing dissociative poetry is, it's a kind of autism. It's a kind of idiot savant poetry, and it really isn't much good for anything except experiencing, you know, the joy of derangement, which is a pleasure. No, disorientation. We all like disorientation. You know, we like unconsciousness. We like consciousness. We like feeling. We like disorientation. Disorientation is one of the pleasures. You know, no doubt about it. But they, you know, forgive them, for they know not what they do.
Okay.
You know.
All right.
And wait a second.
Okay.
Wait a second.
Wait.
Is the thing what that poetry lacks is affection. What it lacks is relationality. What it lacks is, you know, what it lacks is a thematic understructure. So even if a poem appears to be, you know, very sort of hyperbolically multi-voiced and gathering all kinds of things, if it's a good poem, you can tell that it has an organic integrity. It encloses something that maybe can't be said any other way, but it encloses something. It's not a net that lets everything fall through.
Right. Yeah, no, I hear you. I mean, there's a way of sort of creating a linguistic energy that has some kind of value of its own in those particular kinds of poems.
They have lots of energy.
Right, lots of...
Enviable energy.
Right, okay. Let's move on. Let's talk about gender in your poetry. I told you...
About what?
Gender.
Gender.
I told you when we were talking about what we might talk about, that when I was rereading your poems, thinking about this little talk we would have, that... And I sort of guess I should come out as a very unreconstructed old baby boomer feminist who's still sort of carrying around a lot of the old rage. But as I was reading your poems and so much of the content in those poems that has to do with you know, male identity and being a male and testosterone and all that kind of stuff. I found myself thinking, my God, this poetry is beyond gender. And I was shocked to find myself thinking that. So I had to spend a lot of time figuring out what I meant by that. And I think that what I meant was that somehow or other, you have the ability to create... let me see, how would I put it? That you have the ability to sort of free the narrative persona in your poems from specific questions about gender. I mean, we find characters all the time who are very torn up about sort of gender-related issues like love and sex. They're full of gender-based longing or frustration, and yet none of it seems to be tied ultimately to specific gender identities. You read a couple of those poems tonight, but you have many other poems. You have poems where a male narrator has sex with another man in one poem just because, and this is a quote, "In those days I thought I had to do everything I was afraid of, so I lay down with a man." In another poem, a man is sort of stalking his girlfriend, or perhaps she's former girlfriend, because she's in a house making love with another woman. In another poem, the narrator thinks he sees his mother in a lesbian bar and sort of goes into a whole rumination about that. And in one of my very favorite poems, which is called "Poem for Men Only," you really caused me to have a brand new thought about what I, even as the mother of sons and the wife of a man who is an athlete and a coach, I would say you caused me to have a new thought about, and a kindly thought, about the burdens of testosterone. And I really sort of never been put in that place before. So how did you...
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, well, tell us about how you do that.
Well, you know, it's a great compliment you're paying me that you would think of me as post-gender, but... it's not anywhere near the truth, unfortunately. I'm captured in it, but I wrote a lot about it in my first two books, especially because I experienced such anguish about, you know, what masculinity was, and you know that we write out of our pain and we explore it, and it caused me both sort of revulsion and empathy at you know, the testosterone conspiracy and, you know, the cabal, you know, and as a teacher, of course, you know, I would see it every year among my students who were sort of undergoing that transmogrification in which, you know, their features, not personal brothers, their features thickened and coarsened in a certain kind of way as the testosterone really, really, you know, pumped into their systems. And a sort of and a loss of responsiveness and refinement too. I think, you know, I think it's an unacknowledged bad deal, the cultural baggage of being a man. I mean, an easy conclusion to come to. So I think I've written about that with empathy.
Can I interject a question? Yeah. So the culture, what you're calling the culture, unacknowledged cultural baggage of being a man.
Yeah.
Is not sort of paid for by the privileges of being a man?
Well, I don't think it quite works like that. It's not like, you know, balancing the trade deficit, you know? You know? You know,
point to Tony.
It's, you know, right. You know, the unacknowledged and unearned privilege is half the story. And, you know, how many hundreds of years is it going to take us to outgrow that one? You know, but... the wound, you know, the wound, which is the animating factor, the wound, the metaphysical wound, the gender wound of being a man, is what causes so much reprehensible behavior. You know, like, you know, news anchors trying to taunt McCain and Obama into having, you know, some kind of mud fight during a debate. I mean, that's so schoolyard. Mm-hmm. And it's you know, so, all right, that's pathetic. We all know that. So, But what I want to say is this. Right. We suffer gender. It's one of the many kinds of structures that we suffer in intimate and untold, still untold ways, no doubt about it. But I was on the Exercycle, you know. I was running on the treadmill the other day in the hotel gym, which is called a fitness center. And a young woman came into the room. This was yesterday. And she averted her eyes from me. And there would have been a time when I would have explored that in a poem as, you know, the fear, you know, that the genders have for each other. I would have explored it in this way or that way. But the way I would handle it now, I think, is to try to gather as many layers into a poem as possible. So what you have is you have, for example, the psychological layer that maybe she's a shy person. Then you have the gender, you know, the socio-gender element. You know, women have to be careful about making contact with men because of the history of violence of men against women. And then underneath that, you have the metaphysical wound, which is also a reason for not making eye contact with anybody, because we experience our profound isolation and separation from each other, and maybe her not looking at me is a way of being true to that solitude that is one true dimension of our being. No, why should I look at you or smile at you, stranger, and betray the truth of my metaphysical wound? So I feel like all those things can be gotten into a poem, plus fitness center, plus, you know, what's on TV.
Yeah, it's the fitness center that makes it the Tony Hoagland poem.
It's the layer. Yeah, fitness center or a toaster oven, either one of those things are really equally good.
I think a lot of people would agree with me that in saying that you're a very brave poet. And I think the way you write about gender is brave. But you mentioned at the podium that we might talk a little bit about race, because that is a place where you've been very brave and I think very deliberate in, as you said during the reading, in trying to speak about the issue of race in our society, in our time, in our past, but to speak about it from the perspective of a white man, and a white man who lived many years of his life in the South. People in the audience may or may not know that you've been you've taken some hits for some of your poems. There have been questions about whether or not your treatment of race in some poems ultimately ends up being racist in some way or other. I don't know if anyone else felt like this, but when you were reading the rap music poem, the audience felt to me very easy and untense when you began. And then began to get more tense as it progressed, and then sort of went to another place altogether.
It's a great pleasure to feel that in an audience.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
It is. It is. I know exactly what you mean. So you have your way of writing, of addressing race, of bringing it up in poem, is very straightforward, very blunt. Sometimes there does seem to be almost an aggressive edge to what you're bringing into the poem. And when I was thinking about that in the context of our conversation, I began to think about one of your essays, the one called Negative Capability, the part at the end where you talk about the advantage of meanness in poems. So this is how I want to sort of frame this question. Tony talks about the advantage of meanness over other kinds of discourse. I think he seems to see, and correct me if I'm wrong, to see meanness as a way of acquiring linguistic and rhetorical power in poems and over subject matter. So how does writing about race as a white man and having this sort of preference for tonal meanness sort of work together, and how does it
end? Well, you're right, there is aggressiveness in the tonalities, you know, that are in the poems about race. And in a lot of my poems, I think of poems as being sort of a kind of combat between various truths, you know. And I never liked the version of poetry as being a polite and therefore neutered or innocuous art form.
You know, I want it to sort of come through that wall. So, and, you know, it just proves the point of me, you know, not being past gender, because I am angry and afraid and angry and afraid and angry and afraid, and I'm afraid of race. But, you know, it's, I'm a representative person and I'm a representative American. So
hold on a second. I'm afraid of race. What does that mean?
Well, I feel the self-consciousness, which is never explained to white middle class or any kind of, maybe any class of white Americans. You know, you feel, you know, America has this shadow underneath it, the shadow of privilege, shadow of class, shadow of our racial history. You know, so the nervousness of the races around each other. That's what I feel. And I feel lots of, you know, there isn't a thought that I would have in a poem that I haven't had, or a feeling that I haven't had. So anyway, so it's that interesting situation, which I know you're quite aware of, where Black American poets have written powerfully, eloquently, explored, you know, American race. White poets largely haven't. Why? Because it's impossible to talk about without showing your own unacknowledged racism. It's like pulling a potato out of the dirt. It comes up covered with dirt, you know, and you hold it up, and the potato is covered with dirt. And you know, a person could say, you know, oh, look at your potato. It's all dirty with racism. But, you know, I sort of feel like, hey, I pulled up this big potato, you know.
Pulled up this big potato.
I wanted to be, but it's our potato. And it's, you know, it's wonderfully interesting. It's not something that I haven't found it something possible to do in a clean way. And I'm okay with, I'm okay with people not liking it sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's so rare that truth rides into the room on the horse of niceness. It often comes in on the horse of meanness or of aggressiveness, you know, because there's a barrier to break. There's a membrane to break, and the membrane is in me, you know, and it's in, I sort of think, you know, it's in the representative human beings around me. So it makes poetry, as you know, it makes it exciting to write, to see if you can go out to the periphery, not just the cultural periphery, but whatever the perimeter of what you know and don't know is, because whatever system you have is, you know, automatically invalid, because once you have it, you're totally confident and egotistical about knowing that. So you can always go out to the perimeter as a poet. There's always a perimeter, and that's why there's never going to be any shortage of poetic subject matter. And since we have these amazing tools of tone, and so much is changing, that there's so much that's never been looked at, never been put into a poem, never talked about, and we need American poets to do it. I still believe, you know, that like Emerson or like Whitman, that the American poet could come along and say and perfectly encapsulate our situation of bewilderment and privilege, of, a sort of a luxurious metaphysical woundedness, or however you want to say it, and could say it in a way that it would make it clear, and everybody would say, oh, that's what I've been feeling all along, you know, oh, that's what it is. And having felt it and having it identified in a poem would give them a place to start from, and therefore a place to go.
Well, as I said in my introduction, you're moving us way down that road. So thank you very much for your wonderful poems and a beautiful reading. Thank you all for coming.
Great to talk to you. Good.
Yes, we're done.
Okay, thanks.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Heaney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.